This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane. Rwanda and Burundi share some of the same history. The two countries were first governed by the Germans and then by the Belgians in colonial times as one territory called Rwanda-Urundi. Burundi and Rwanda are each comprised of a Tutsi minority and a Hutu majority. Burundi's first democratically elected president was assassinated in a coup attempt by Tutsi army officers last October. 50,000 Burundis were killed in the 4 weeks following the coup, and 100,000 were displaced. This past April, the interim president of Burundi and the president of Rwanda were both killed in a suspicious airplane crash. While there has been ethnic fighting in Burundi since April, it's not nearly on the scale of neighboring Rwanda. But relief and humanitarian groups are concerned about the upheaval that may lie ahead. Susan Walker just returned from a 3-week visit to Burundi. She went as part of a team sponsored by Physicians for Human Rights to evaluate the situation there and to recommend ways to head off a crisis. She has spent the last 15 years in Asia working with refugees in emergency situations. She told me that they had access to all kinds of government officials and recognized groups in Burundi, but they didn't want to limit their investigations to people in the elite.
What we did in our travels through the provinces, which were the central, north, and northeast provinces, and then back to Bujumbura, the capital, was to conduct a health questionnaire, and we interviewed women with children all along the way.
Why did you want to talk to women and children? Why was that important to gauge their sense of what was going on in their country?
Well, we felt that we would be able to get information about what was actually going on in the countryside from the women who would perhaps be less politicized. And in many humanitarian or human rights crises, it's oftentimes the women and the children who are suffering as a result of the internal or external strife that is going on or in war situations. And many of these women had lost husbands or sons or brothers during the massacres, although many women and children were also killed during the massacres. But it's oftentimes the women you can get a reflection of the health conditions, particularly of the children. And the women spoke about, for instance, if they had just given birth, they didn't have enough milk to nurse their child because they were sick or worried or didn't have enough food because they had been displaced for a long period of time. And we did see and get reports from the UN that malnutrition has increased and also the vaccination percentage has decreased during the time since October.
So I assume you talked to both Hutus and Tutsis?
Yes, actually, we made a point, of course, of speaking with both Hutu and Tutsi. And in fact, for our interpreters, we had two women interpreters. One was a Hutu, one was a Tutsi. And we interviewed both Hutu and Tutsi. The Tutsi, for the most part, were the ones in the displaced camps because many of them are still afraid to go home. And I think the Hutus, many of them have returned home, but I don't know that I've ever seen a country that has been quite as devastated for the physical structure. The homes are made out of either this clay material or bricks, and many of the areas, in fact, most of the areas, I would say 90% of the homes were destroyed, so a lot needs to be rebuilt.
Now, you went there to evaluate the political and social climate to get a sense about how close Burundi is to crisis. What's your impression?
Well, I think our delegation felt at the end of the 3 weeks from the people that we were able to interview and also the actual experience we had during that time, firsthand experience from interviews, that it is a very explosive, precarious situation. And there are a number of things that need to be done urgently, immediately, in order to prevent another major explosion in the country bordering Rwanda. And of course, it has to be looked at in a regional context as well, because if there is, an outflow from Rwanda following the withdrawal of the French later this month, and they were already saying that hundreds are on the road toward Bukavu, that could have a big effect on Burundi. But right now, what they need to do is get the government in place. They need to decide on a president, whether it's the current interim president or another one. And the political parties have been in negotiations for months. I understand there is an August 26th deadline that President Silvestre has set to come up with a decision. So that is ongoing now. And also, there are a number of other things which I think the international community can have an effect, is to increase the number of observers. There's a very minimal number of observers in the country, and I think both from human rights, criminal justice, and potentially military observers, increasing those numbers in Burundi will have a very important effect.
When you say the situation in Burundi is explosive and precarious, is that based on the level of fear that you observed, expressions of hatred across ethnic lines? Is it also because of the civil war in Rwanda right next door?
Well, I think actually all of those are factors. There certainly is a climate of terror and fear in the country. And also, we heard that children don't even express their feelings, that they don't cry. I think they've seen so many horror stories and their parents being killed since last October and other family members, that the fear is just pervasive. But it's not only that. There were incidents during the time that we were there, for instance, in the province of Muramvya, exactly at the time we went through, which was July 22nd, that two-week period, there were between 200 and 300 villagers killed during disarmament or pacification campaigns going on in the hillsides, and their homes burned. Now, that was reported and confirmed by several sources. And in June and July, three other incidents, major incidents, were massacres of refugees, Rwandan refugees that had come to Burundi, again, ethnically motivated. It was between Hutu and Tutsi. But in those incidents, a total of over 200 refugees were killed and massacred in a very brutal, violent fashion. This is just an example of what is going on rather consistently in the country. And even now, this past week, it's been very tense in Bujumbura. They have campaigns that they call Ville Morte, which in English means actually dead city. But what they do is put the city at a standstill. And there was violence the weekend after we left, so last weekend in Bujumbura, with several people killed by grenade attacks in the city. And in speaking with the UN people in Burundi this morning, there are also tensions of this happening again this week.
Who is behind the killings? And when you talk about the they, who's the they?
Well, it depends. There are killings on both sides, ethnically revenge motivated between Hutu and Tutsi. There are also Tutsi military, because the military is primarily a Tutsi ethnic group, that are doing these disarmament campaigns in the countryside, and inevitably they oftentimes end up with villagers being killed or hurt or their homes burned. But there are also stories of Hutu that have seen their families killed, killing Tutsis. And I think, as you brought in the international aspect of Rwanda, we have also felt that with the victory of the RPF in Rwanda, that could possibly give confidence to the Tutsi ethnic minority in Burundi. So I think all of this is a very, very delicate balance with a number of factors that will determine if Burundi is able to remain stable or not.
When you talk about the growing numbers of children who are malnourished, makes me wonder whether you see Burundi as a functioning country, whether, for instance, schools are in operation, whether there is a functioning economy, whether people are able to plant and harvest crops.
Well, I think this was one of the problems, of course, since October, with the vast number of internally displaced people. The crops could not be planted. And I think Burundi, whereas it's been food self-sufficient in the past, now has a 24% shortage a shortfall until the end of this year in food supplies and is dependent on international aid to make that up. We did meet with the World Food Program people, and they felt that the situation was under control. People are slowly coming back to their fields, slowly planting them again, and they anticipate that next year the food situation should be, again, hopefully self-sufficient. But again, in the region, if it explodes, that will impact directly on Burundi. So I think the situation is slowly coming back to a more stable situation in the country, with schools again functioning and the economy, the coffee plantations and sorghum and all of this starting again. You do see economic activity. But again, I think it's so precarious that if things like the government is not set, and also I think the international observers, the criminal justice system is a key player, because many Burundians spoke to us, from government officials to just the local villagers, about impunity, that this killing is going on and no one is being punished because the criminal justice system doesn't work. And if this is allowed to go on, the vengeance and the revenge killings will continue.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest is Susan Walker, and she was a member of a team of four representatives of Physicians for Human Rights. They just spent 3 weeks in Burundi evaluating the political and social situation there. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Susan Walker, and we're talking about her visit to Burundi. She went there with Physicians for Human Rights to evaluate the climate there and to institute and make recommendations for what can be done to head off a civil war there. Your team discovered a mass grave in a province there, the northeast corner of the Kirundo province. How did you find out about this mass grave?
Well, actually, it was during our travels in the provinces. In each province, we would meet with the governor to inform them about the Physicians for Human Rights mission, and also to get his approval for work in the province. And that we did in each province. The governor of Kirundo province, when we explained what our mandate was in looking at human rights issues, also regarding refugees, he said, "Oh, I just had one of the villagers from my province come last Friday." This was actually the 22nd of July. And report that he had come back from Rwanda and had found a mass grave on his land. And this mass grave, we asked, because Physicians for Human Rights in many countries has been asked to come either for exhumations or autopsies to investigate torture cases and whatnot. So we went with the administrator to visit this mass grave, and it was 14 meters by 4 meters. And very obviously, human bodies in this grave. There were actually some parts of bodies sticking up through the surface. It was very shallow. You could see shirts. You could see a foot. You could see rib cages. And also, the stench was very overpowering, because there is suspicion that these were more than 100 Rwandan refugees killed on the 11th of June. Eyewitnesses implicate both Tutsi military from Burundi and also Tutsi civilians in this. And
so there were witnesses to at least some form of mass execution?
Yes, we spoke actually ourselves with the eyewitnesses, who are under UN protection, so it's a very sensitive matter. They are living under UN protection now. And the court case, or in fact, it's the criminal justice system so far, there is an investigation going on. But really, for instance, this was an example of the criminal justice system not working. Here is a discovery of a mass grave site potentially containing more than 100 bodies. And we got permission all the way up to the Minister of Justice in Bujumbura to do an exhumation coming back the following week. So doing it all officially. And then it was blocked at the local level. We were not allowed to continue the investigation. All we wanted to confirm under UNHCR auspices, and also Amnesty International happened to be doing a similar mission, so we asked them to join us. They had a jurist from Chad who was an expert in this kind of investigation of mass graves, so very useful to have the jurist along. And we were not allowed to identify either the number of bodies in, or we wanted to see if they were male or female and how they had been killed, basically. And this was not allowed to proceed, people saying, and I think this is a kind of an example of what is going on in the country. Probably it was a deterrent to stop the investigation, but they said, why are you interested in this mass grave? There are mass graves all over the country.
But why do you think it was blocked at the local level if there was some national interest and support, at least trying to figure out what happened here?
Not being a political expert, I don't know if I can give a definitive assessment of that, but I would guess it's the military who had the final say on this on a local level. And in most developing countries or situation of war, even the central level will defer to local level. And the local level said, ethnic tensions are so high in this area, this could cause a very violent reaction by exhuming the grave, that it's not local custom to do this, and that it will create tensions in an already tense province. And it's true, it is tense up there, but I think that was more giving an excuse, we said privately to some of the officials, well, we also presume it's not Burundi custom to massacre people and put them in a mass grave. But on this, it was the military and other local officials blocking this investigation, and it will be pursued. At the day that we went back, and in fact were not able to complete the investigation, we were accompanied by UNHCR officials from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and also, though not by our invitation, it was an independent visit by the United States Ambassador, who we had informed, and the UN Secretary General's Special Rapporteur for Burundi, his political advisor, also went and were able to see the mass grave.
So has anyone determined who the victims were?
That is still not known at this time, because an exhumation was not allowed. Everyone says, well, we assume, we have heard from whatever sources, which are not identified, that these are presumably the refugees, but that has not been proven.
Why is it important to have trials for human rights abuses or human rights crimes if there is a fear of fanning ethnic hatred?
Well, I think the problem is to have a criminal justice system that works, that people are not allowed to kill other human beings with impunity, because that is, in fact, what creates a lot of the fear. Many of the villagers that we spoke to say they're still sleeping outside of their homes because they're afraid of being attacked at night. I mean, to this day, they were sleeping out in the bush at night because they were afraid of being attacked. And I think if they felt, and many of them said, I mean, just in their very non-political, simple village viewpoint, saying, but people are killing, if they can continue, then we will continue to live in fear. So the question of impunity was brought up at all levels of society in Burundi as a problem by the Burundians themselves.
There certainly was worldwide reluctance to head off the violence in Rwanda. Do you think anything has changed to involve the world community in the future of Burundi?
Well, I hope that it will change in the near future. Unfortunately, my experience in 15 years of emergency humanitarian relief work is that it oftentimes is too late before an intervention happens, and then you have a major disaster. And I think that was one of the purposes of the PHR mission, was a preventive action to avoid something like this happening. There's already been a tragedy of 50,000 people massacred in this country last October, and it would be a very sad and tragic reflection on international response to such situations if it were allowed to happen again. And, of course, there are no guarantees that international observers or naming a government or this kind of thing can really prevent what is going to happen. But I think it would go a long way in preventing another disaster.
Do you see progress in the last 15 years? It often appears that there are more and more refugees in the world as civil wars erupt around the globe.
Well, that's absolutely true. There are 20 million refugees, I think, worldwide now, and 25 million internally displaced. And it's a huge global problem, which requires global interest. I mean, we all have our individual lives to be concerned with, but I think people need to have a more global view if this is not to get worse. And I must admit, having worked 15 years in Asia, when I went to Burundi, I was not quite expecting this, but many of the same memories that I had of the horrors of the Khmer Rouge coming in 79 from refugees coming across the border into Thailand were repeated or renewed when I heard about the atrocities in Rwanda and Burundi. And that's very sad. But I don't know how we can have one corner of the world learn from another, or Bosnia-Herzegovina. There are a lot of atrocities going on throughout the world, and I don't know the answer to that, but I think we all need to work together to find one for that.
Susan Walker, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Susan Walker just returned from Burundi. She was part of a team of medical personnel sponsored by Physicians for Human Rights. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.